now. Thank you. I have been requested to announce that the communication conference will be held here in this building on May 13, 14. This is on the direction of the Program Services Department and others associated with him. I hope that you avail yourself to this opportunity. Again, thank you for coming. And now, this afternoon, I want you to hear my friend and your friend, Reverend John Fleming, who is officially the Director of Admissions of Shaw University of Raleigh, North Carolina. Brother Fleming has served in this capacity for a period of 12 years and also has served as the Director of Christian Education for the General Baptist Convention of North Carolina. He is a graduate of Shaw University, has done graduate studies at Oberlin College in the state of Ohio. And Brother Fleming, I'm sure that all of these people here join me in saying welcome this afternoon, and we hear you prayerfully now as you come and give us a challenge as individual church members in this urban community in which we live.
Thank you very much. It is both a privilege and an opportunity to be present and to participate in the program of the Metropolitan Missions Conference. I must deal with a subject today that calls for me to pull three elements together: challenge, church member, urban community. This is no easy task. To talk about the church member facing up to the issues and problems of urbanization brings quickly to mind a verse from the pen of Hugh Mearns. As I was going up the stair, I met a man who wasn't there. He wasn't there again today. I wish he'd stay away. Mr. Average church member is not there where the action is in the urban community. The correspondence between the profession of the heart and the outward act has not been up to par. Church members need to update the mail line between the inner life and the outward manifestation, between the creed and the deed, between what they are and what Jesus Christ calls them to be. They need to get away from the erratic an undependable style of the Pony Express and come up to the standard of the fast and accurate style of modern communication. Too many church members, particularly in the urban setting, have lost the Christian message somewhere between the inner spirit and the life of involvement. But we should not move out ahead of our message. Let us first take a look at the urban community. Cities differ in some respects. Population of American cities run from 25,000 to approximately 8 million. Land area varies from city to city, and there are other physical differences. When we think of cities, however, we are struck by the similarities. We think of common elements: overcrowdedness, air pollution, traffic snarls, delinquency and crime, substandard housing, mental disorders, alcoholism, suicide, and other marks of social disorder. We see the cities as fractured communities. Urbanization is far more than a physical phenomenon. It is a way of life. As Harvey Cox points out, urbanization constitutes a massive change in the way men live together. Commenting further, Cox goes on to say, urbanization means a structure of common life in which diversity and the disintegration of tradition are paramount. It means a type of impersonality in which functional relationships multiply. The urban center is the place of human control, of rational planning, of bureaucratic organization. It is everywhere. The age of the secular technological city, like all preceding ages, does have its own characteristic style. Cox describes that style under the contrived term technopolis to signify the fusion of technological and political components into the base on which a new cultural style has appeared. This theologian, highly influenced by modern sociology, uses anonymity and mobility to describe the shape of technopolis, and pragmatism, the practical result, and profanity having to do with this world, to describe the style of technopolis. Where Cox is somewhat optimistic about the urban community and sees the characteristics of its shape and style as having constructive values, other thinkers are not quite so optimistic about our cities. Cox does make an important observation that has bearing on what we are trying to say. Technopolis is more descriptive of a mood of an age than of a place. The urbanization process of the 20th century has been effective. Those who dwell in the rural areas cannot escape its impact. Even those people who call themselves creating the anti-city, suburbia, feel its tentacles embracing them. Though the suburbanite tries to establish anti-city values by substituting homogeneity for mixture, dispersion for concentration, and the middle range for specialization, he has been caught up by a this-worldliness, a secularity as much as the man who dwells in the city proper. So, no matter where we are, rural or suburbia, we are still faced with the mood, the mode, and the way of living as implied in the term technopolis. The medium has been the message. Radios, televisions, and other means of automated communication have almost made technopolis a universal concept. Joseph Horatiunian, with whom I am in basic agreement, sees the urban way of life as one of self-interest. It falls short of the task of bringing races and classes into a community of persons. There is no such thing, according to his thinking, as an enlightened self-interest. In the self-interest-oriented urban community, money has been enthroned as the deity, and economic determinism has become the religion. Horatiunian comments, the evil consequence of such subordination of human values to economic advantages are all too evident. Men are estranged from one another and lost in the crowd of our urban society. This, then, is the urban community. Selfishness, human despair, disillusionment, dog-eat-dog attitude are all found there. And as Horatiunian adds, selfishness no longer appears as a temptation. It becomes natural, and men practice it with energy, even if with a confused conscience. The industrial society thus becomes an acquisitive society, and acquisition becomes the predominant motive of human activity. Rousseau may have had something when, at an early stage of his philosophical thinking, he viewed the life of the noble savage as the best life and thought that the worst thing that ever happened occurred when the first man built a fence around a plot of land and said, "This is mine." The urban mood promotes a property emphasis at the expense of personality. Acquisitiveness has created selfishness, injustice, a culture of poverty and discontent. Carlo Armani was keenly aware of the problem when he said in an address, "The method to face the myth about property and the absurd notion that poverty is its opposite. Property and poverty are synonyms. The opposite of both is community. This matter of selfish interest has kept the city from achieving true community. The picture we see is not a pretty one. If we have attentive ears, we should listen to the warning coming from the report of the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders. It warned the American, white or black, no American, white or black, can escape the consequences of the continuing social and economic decay of our major cities. Michael Harrington calls to our attention a contrast between community and and society that was drawn up by the German sociologist Tarnies in the 1880s. His thesis stated in essence that the city, rather than becoming a community where that which binds men together is seen as a real and organic life, has become a society, an ideal and mechanical formulation. Harrington, in further elaboration, said, community, Tarnies concluded with seminal fatalism, inevitably degenerates into society, and the harbinger of decline was the great city, the center of anti-folk. Another thinker reminds us that community life has, in our time, become as difficult as it is imperative. Here then, in a nutshell, is the problem of the urban community. Its pro-thing and anti-folk attitude has operated against the spiritual togetherness that characterizes the true community. Let us move on to the second element, the church member. The church member is too often the victim of the doctrine of individuality, particularly the urban church member. Individualism within the context of Christianity makes for Christian isolationism, and Christian isolationism is a contradiction in terms. An individual per se does not exist from the time that one is born until the time of his death. His life is made up of a series of relationships and interactions. No one of us can live to himself alone. Therefore, individuality living in a vacuum is impossible. But personality, maintaining uniqueness in the midst of relationships, is not only possible, but desirable. The church member in the urban community must be one whose personality interacts with other community forces. He has ethical and moral obligations built into the very fabric of the Judeo-Christian heritage is an ethical side. The Ten Commandments start with man's relationship to God and move on to man's relationship to his fellow men. The extremely social conscious prophets preface their prophecy with, "Thus saith the Lord," and Jesus declared that the commandment to love was of a dual nature, directed toward God and toward one's neighbor. And love for Jesus was not an abstract term, but an active force, as illustrated in the Good Samaritan and the Prodigal Son parables. The Christian heritage, then, is concerned with promoting the welfare of other persons. This does not mean a neglect of our own welfare. I conceive of the kingdom of God as a beloved commonwealth where the common fatherhood of God makes for the brotherhood of all men. The experience of the church member starts with, in a personal manner, that is, with conversion. But conversion turns the converted into leaven. It changes not only the individual's personal life, but also his response to his pattern of interactions. Paul described the convert as a new creation. Behold, the old has passed away. Everything has become new. In another place, he hints that the new life means control of, rather than adjustment to, the environment. Be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewal of your mind, that ye may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. And once again, Horatonian comes to our help. He writes, the new life is at once the life of the community and the life of the person. The community is formed by conversion, and conversion is into the body of Christ, or the Christian community. This community has its origin neither in natural affinity nor in a natural necessity, but in God, in an act of God, and by the will of God. And the act stems from a psychological and spiritual togetherness. The book of Acts describes it. All that believed were together and of one accord, and no one said that which he possessed was his own, but they had everything in common. These same people who discovered the inner unity of community were also the ones who turned the world upside down. Not John the Baptist, with his emphasis on withdrawal and asceticism, but Jesus Christ, with his emphasis on involvement, is the prototype of the Christian faith. He came not to bring peace, but a sword. He came to cast fire upon the earth. And as Elton Trueblood has so aptly said, the deep meaning of this is that a Christian individual or a Christian society which does not start a conflagration is not Christian at all. The gospel taken seriously can open up many avenues of interaction for the church member. Victor Obenhaus once made a statement which is a good summary of the responsible church member. The manner, he said, which laymen bring their faith to bear upon society's most critical issues will test the vitality and depth of their faith. Vitality and depth go together. And I say that this is not only true of the layman, but for the minister as well. And with that, we move on to the third pertinent term of our subject. To state it succinctly, the challenge to the church member in the urban community is to make his Christianity socially relevant. An ethicist has said, in periods of social upheaval and ferment, men are pressed to look again at their heritage of theological foundations. The conscientious and thoughtful Christian does not wait for calamity to move to him. He asks, what does God require of me now? His convictions about God's own order are his ultimate, his most important concerns. These are his theological foundations. In answering, what does God require of me now? Jesus adopted a program from Isaiah. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. If you are responding to the basic question in the light of Jesus' response, how do you react to the critical issue of race in the city, black people with little or no representation in municipal government, the last to be hired and the first to be fired, assigned to the hot, heavy, and hard jobs, some victims of a permanent depression, children denied basic rights. Do you handle this challenge by using the Calvinistic doctrine that riches represent a Christian virtue based on thrift and hard work, and that the troubles of the black ghetto are due to laziness? Have you given any consideration to the aforementioned advisory report on civil disorders and its claim concerning the problems of the black ghetto, that white institutions created it, white institutions maintain it, and white society condones it? Do you still believe that in race relations, charity and paternalism are substitutes for justice? The question of race is a real challenge to the church member in the urban community. Ignoring the situation does not make the problem disappear. And to claim that uprisings and rebellions by ghetto-oppressed blacks is destroying good race relations is to talk about the destruction of something that never existed. It takes dialogue among peers to produce good race relations. We have never had that. A lack of dialogue has been guaranteed by closed housing, restrictive covenants, segregated churches, segregated schools de jure in the past and de facto today, and a lack of fair representation on police forces and in National Guards. And such acts have created a fractured community. Much can be said in other areas where the church member has been quiet. Poverty programs, employment, crime, and not only those who commit crimes in the streets, but those who ride by night, those who exploit, intimidate, and commit acts of reprisals, immorality, health programs, and war, and all those critical issues which confront urban life should be of social relevance for the church member and should call for his involvement in working toward solutions. You ask, what can I do? That is the challenge. Don't you believe in the leavening quality of the gospel, or the gadfly technique used by Socrates in ancient Athens? Suppose one little Jew, Paul, had not risen to meet the challenge of that question. Henry Hitt Crane once described Paul as a thermostat in contrast to a thermometer, one who controlled his environment rather than adjust to it. Therein lies the challenge to the church member in the city. Be a thermostat, not a thermometer. The challenge of the church member in the urban setting is to bring the spirit of the beloved community to bear on his environment. He must protest against any type of inequality that is dehumanizing and a denial of the God image in man. And then he must move to a positive approach. As D.R. Sharp once put it, the beloved community made up of individual Christians must draw together all the people on the basis of essential equality of opportunity and without regard to race, color, creed, or economic status. It must guarantee equal educational opportunities, equal economic and employment opportunities, equal chance for decent housing, equal health protection and care, equal cultural advantages, equal use of the radio, television, and press, equal recreational opportunities, equal status in all public transportation facilities, equal civic and public accommodation, equal right to vote, equal laws and enforcement thereof, equal civil rights protection, equal personal and social status, equal freedom of physical movement, equal right to choose and own a home, to marry and rear children, equal right to conduct business, equal access to the means of finance and credit, equal freedom from all restriction, save those that are common to all. What I have tried to say in terms of the challenge of the urban setting for the church member is to take your religion out of the mothballs of privacy and bring it out into the open air of social relevancy. Remember, as church members, you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's own people, that you may declare the wonderful deeds of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Once you were no people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not obtained mercy, but now you have obtained mercy. Harvey Cox, Carlyle Monnie, and some other thinkers have said that this age calls for a new breed Christian in some respects, because urbanization as a mood is a comparatively recent phenomenon. They are right, but I say we also need an old breed Christian, cut in the mold of Jesus, who went about doing good. The challenge to the church member in the urban community is the challenge of involvement. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brother Fleming. Now I'd like for Brother John Bright to come.